Spider Podcast, I'm Adam Brimelow. We're pulling through what many people regard as the toughest winter in the history of the NHS. It's been a long, hard haul with record demand, the added pressures of continuing COVID and flu, and of course, the impact of industrial action. And while there are some signs that the worst is over for now, many staff and services are still overstretched with consequent delays for patients. We do, however, have an urgent and emergency care recovery plan backed by some funding to increase capacity and hopefully reduce bed occupancy for next time round. Will it work? Well, let's go through some of this. In a moment, we'll be hearing from NHS providers Jonathan Holmes and Luis Costa da Silva on the winter data and ambulance pressures. But first, the story of the NHS winter through a media lens with our own head of media, Susan Ball. I started by asking her, what were Trust leaders' big concerns as we headed into winter? So, Susan, there was obviously a lot of apprehension as we were heading towards the winter months, not least because winter is always a tougher time for trusts. What were the big concerns we were hearing about from trust leaders as we headed into winter?
So our State of the Provider Sector survey, which we launched at our annual conference in November, painted a really worrying picture for us and basically illustrated how concerned trust leaders were about what winter would bring for them. So one of the key statistics that we found in our survey was that 85% of the trust leaders that we surveyed were more worried about this winter than any other. And they were really worried about the impact of the winter on their staff. So another really interesting fact was that 93% were worried about burnout across their workforce. And we know that that's been a really pressing issue for trust leaders for a really long time in terms of the concerns that they've got about staff morale, about burnout. And they were also telling us about how concerned they were about their capacity to meet demand for services over the next 12 months. And we know that there were big problems with concerns over meeting waiting lists and the care backlog more broadly. And what we found quite telling was that nearly half of them told us that they weren't on course to meet the end of year elective recovery and cancer targets. That really hit home for us, just the sheer scale of the pressure that they were facing as we headed into another winter.
So they were worried. And as we moved into winter, those worries were in large part vindicated. The story of the NHS winter yet again being up there in lights in terms of media coverage. What sort of questions were you getting from journalists about the problems that were surfacing?
Well, if we go back a few months, so I think it's really interesting to see the trajectory of the questions that we were getting and how they changed over time. So if we start with the warnings that we initially got from the UK HSA about the warnings of the twindemic, so there were concerns about flu and COVID both coming at the same time and the impact that could have on trusts. So we had journalists asking us about how trusts were preparing for that, how they would cope. And I know this feels like a distant memory now, but some of you might recall that there were also then warnings from the National Blood Service about blood stocks running low. And we were then getting questions from journalists about, well, how would trusts cope with that? Would operations and procedures have to be cancelled? What kind of mitigations were being put in place? And then throughout this period, we were also getting questions about the maintenance backlog. So new figures had come out that the maintenance backlog facing trusts was now around the 10 billion mark. So the questions from journalists were around, what are trusts doing to kind of manage then minimise the risks to patients? What impact is this having on your ability to manage care backlogs? And then as we got into the depths of winter, the questions from the journalists started then to focus on delayed discharges, ambulance handover delays. They were really keen on finding out more from trust leaders about where the problems lay and what impact it was having on trusts, both at the front door and in helping patients move through the system. But also they were interested in how the process could be speeded up. And then as kind of winter progressed and we started getting the outcomes of ballots from various trade unions, the questions then started to focus for us on how were trusts preparing for industrial action, what measures were being put in place, how would they support their staff, what would be the impact on patients. And then as time went on and the statistics started coming through in terms of the number of appointments and procedures that had to be postponed, there were then questions about what is the longer term impact on patients. And then throughout this, we would constantly get questions of what does the NHS need from the government to help it through another winter crisis? So lots of kind of different questions coming at us in all different directions, really.
Yeah, all different directions, problems and challenges almost wherever you look. And of course, some really harrowing stories Absolutely. About the way this was impacting on patients, yet important to keep sight of the great work that has continued and important sort of innovations that trusts have turned to. How do you strike that balance between acknowledging, recognising the scale and gravity of the challenges and yet highlighting the great work that trusts have been doing even in these very difficult circumstances?
Yeah, I think that's a really important issue for NHS providers as a membership organisation. And I think it's important to remember with the NHS that nothing is ever black and white. And so for us as an organisation representing those members, we do really need to strike that balance. And so even though it was obvious to everyone who was kind of watching the NHS statistics and the pressures on the NHS over winter, it was also important to reflect that despite those pressures, there was really good work being done by trust leaders and their teams at the same time. So in terms of bearing down on like waiting times and the care backlog, and I think it's a really good opportunity actually now to give a shout out for NHS providers' Winter Watch series. So each week when the Winter Sit Rep data is published, alongside that we also publish a case study in which we focus on the really good work that NHS trusts are doing to support patients and other kind of partners that they're working with in the health and care system to kind of manage winter pressures. And also our Providers Deliver series is a really important vehicle for us to share the good work of trusts in terms of tackling the care backlog, supporting the workforce. So what I would say is that yes, the NHS has come under pressure, but that is alongside really good work being done by trusts to bear down on care backlogs. And I think it's important that as a membership organisation, we reflect that in our media outputs.
Yeah, and we know from conversations with trust leaders, obviously a key motivation underlying all they do is providing good quality
Absolutely.
Care for patients. This winter, that has been incredibly difficult and sometimes it's not happened. And the NHS has had to acknowledge that at times it has fallen short. In terms of your exchanges with the media, how much of a risk do you think there is of that becoming almost normalised, people becoming immune to the stories of incredibly challenging performance situations for the NHS and it becoming a state of being, which is clearly something that everyone in the NHS will be very, very keen to avoid?
Yeah, it's a really good point and I think it is a big concern for trusts that, like you were saying, that people do become immune to kind of the bad news stories. And I think it is important to kind of reflect that there are challenges in the system, but also to, again, to highlight where good work is being done. But I think we're not here to kind of gloss over where things haven't kind of gone right. I think it's important to acknowledge that there are pressures, but also to reflect where kind of positive work is being done and to kind of highlight that work as and when we can.
Susan Ball there. So did that media narrative align with the official winter data? Was it really the worst winter on record? A question for NHS providers senior research analyst Luis Costa da Silva. So Luis, we heard from Susan there about the media narrative, but what does the data tell us? Was it really the worst winter for the NHS on record?
That's right, Adam. Data showed that it was a really challenging winter indeed. It was the first winter since COVID where essentially all the elements are back on the table for the trusts to manage. That means COVID pressures, that means flu back to pre-pandemic levels, but also the elective recovery and the wider backlog recovery happening as well. In previous years, the trusts were able to pause the elective care so they could create room for these UEC pressures. But this winter, trusts have had to be a little bit more agile and to work with system partners to ensure that the elective care was ongoing. The data was also showing that bed occupancy remained very high throughout the winter and that trusts were incredibly busy. So, for example, we've seen that the diagnostics in December were above pre-pandemic levels and also above 1 year ago. And at the same time, we saw that trusts were tackling the elective backlog, but waiting lists were still very high. So we had 7.2 million people waiting in December, for example. And obviously, an additional challenge that was unique to this winter was the industrial action that saw over 144,000 postponed appointments, on top of other workforce challenges, such as absences and vacancies.
And when you look at the urgent and emergency care aspect, that's where, of course, there was a real focus in terms of some of the concerns over delays people were facing, the impact on safety there. Where were the real pinch points?
Well, we saw in December, it was a particularly busy month for ambulance services, for example, and we have the highest number of Category 1 incidents on record, over 101,000, and was almost one-fifth higher than any previous record. We also saw that Category 2 call average response times climbed to about an hour and a half, and the Category 1 calls response time also rose to nearly 11 minutes, which is very high. Equally, in December, we saw a record number of A&E attendances at 2.3 million. So the pressures are very challenging across the ambulance services and A&E.
And of course, those are the measurements that we get to hear about. It's absolutely clear, isn't it, that those sorts of pressures were being felt right across the NHS and including community as well.
Yes, that's right, Adam. We also saw that pressures were being felt across community services. We had, for example, 1.5 million people referred to community services in November alone. And equally in mental health services, the pressures were high. It was a particularly busy period for mental health services. We saw, for example, over 420,000 mental health referrals, which is up by nearly one third since before the pandemic. And we also had around 1.7 million people in contact with mental health services, which is up by over a fifth since before the pandemic. And on top of that, we also have, of course, the elective care and diagnostic waiting lists remaining very high, despite the efforts across systems to recover the care backlogs.
So a really challenging picture. What do you think were the particular factors this year that made it so hard?
We saw what was described by many people as a twindemic, and that just means a combination of flu and COVID hitting hard for both patients and staff, really. We also saw staffing pressures as an issue, so the absences, as we've mentioned before, but also the ongoing vacancies, as well as the industrial action that happened. On top of that, we also know that there are system-wide issues in the social care sector, which are often related and reflected in patient flow. So, for example, an ongoing pressure we keep seeing are delayed discharges. And as a result of that, a large proportion of medically fit patients are staying in hospital after discharge. We had a record of 62.2% in the week between the 2nd and the 8th of January. And this is just another symptom of the chronic lack of capacity in social and community care. But equally, we've seen patient flow across the system has struggled with the growing ambulance handover delays, as we were seeing earlier, and the long waits in A&E that we also have seen for well over a decade, really.
So one other thing we got this winter was an urgent and emergency care recovery plan with targets for the future on how the NHS will be expected to perform. Two key ones there, one on four-hour waiting times in A&E and another one, the Category 2 ambulance response times, both of which, of course, have taken a hit during the course of this winter, as you've described. Those targets really look pretty modest, don't they, set against what we've come to expect in the past. What do you think that tells us about the state of pressures in urgent and emergency care and the sense of optimism about really making rapid progress in recovering standards?
Yeah, it feels as if NHS England have set out a plan that is more realistic and is aimed at driving recovery over essentially a more feasible timeline. And to support recovery, the delivery plan sets out a couple of ambitions that you've mentioned, specifically that patients are being seen more quickly in emergency departments. So it's aiming to improve to 76% of patients being admitted, transferred or discharged within 4 hours. And that's by March 2024. And equally that ambulances are getting to patients quicker. So improving ambulance response times for the Category 2 incidents to 30 minutes on average over the course of 2023 and 24. And given, you know, the scale of pressures and impact on patients and staff, this plan has a sense of realism in how it will help address the demand for the urgent and emergency care pathways over the coming year. But it's also important to note that meeting the targets will depend on many factors, including the NHS's ability to recruit and retain staff, and for trusts to access sufficient capital investment that they desperately need to help clear the maintenance backlog and transform services, as we've mentioned earlier.
That was Luis Costa da Silva. So let's look at ambulances. I asked Jonathan Holmes, policy advisor on ambulances and operational performance at NHS providers, why ambulances came to the fore this winter as never before.
Yeah, it's an interesting and difficult question, which I'm not really sure of the specific answer to, but my thoughts on it would be that the issue kind of started and all the signs were there kind of back in the summer when we saw performance across a range of measures in the NHS really start to dip. And we kind of got this phenomena almost of seeing winter levels of pressure in June and July. And that kind of carried on through into the winter months. And I think one of the things that really stood out in all of that was category two ambulance response times, which are for potentially life-threatening things like chest pain, strokes. So really at the serious end of things, and waiting times kind of getting as long as half an hour. And then as we got into the winter months, climbing up to as high as an hour, to then almost an hour and a half at their very worst. And that's against a performance requirement of 18 minutes. So I think one of the reasons is that it was really, really very bad, and it built up and sustained over a long time. And then I think on the other side of it is the fact that the public, and I think the media as well, really understand and can comprehend when you've got chest pains or a stroke, things that we all know you need to respond to really fast. Kind of the idea that you might have to wait an hour, I think that's quite visceral. And it scares us a bit. It kind of cuts through. So I think that's it. It was the severity and just kind of how visceral and understandable the issue was to such a wide part of the country.
Yeah, and you talk about those delayed response times, and there was that real focus, wasn't there, as well, on handover delays as a key part of the problem. There was that interface that got a lot of attention, but really that was a manifestation of a much wider system problem, wasn't it, in terms of the capacity to deal with the pressures?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's, again, it's something that as an image, as an experience, is something even those of us who don't work in the NHS can understand and empathize with. You've kind of got these long queues. And so, again, it's like this really visible flashpoint for issues that are really complex. They're about a system, they're about things going on elsewhere, but this is just the point where we can really see it and it's really visible, and it's something we can really clearly understand how negative an experience it would be to be there. But as you say, this is an issue of systems. The reason that you get a queue of ambulances at the front door is because there aren't enough beds to admit a patient to. The reason there aren't enough beds to admit a patient to are because people are staying longer in hospital, and because it's taking longer than it should do to get people out of the hospital, because often of a lack of capacity in social care or elsewhere in the community. So you've almost kind of got a situation where a failure to invest in social care over a long time now translates to a long queue of ambulances at the front door, and a lot of interconnections and challenges across all of that. And that's just where we can really just see it all end up. And it's something we can understand and empathize with, I suppose.
Yeah. And you talked about the consequences of delays in terms of what that means, certainly for the public as it looks on and for patients. But we shouldn't forget also the impact on staff morale as well, as they try to deliver help that's so urgently required.
Yeah, I think it's something we've seen very recently with stuff that's come out in the NHS staff survey. The morale, experiences of work and levels of stress are really in a bad, bad place. And I think something that's so important to bear in mind, I really don't think anybody in the NHS turns up to work or starts out their career thinking that they're going to deliver care that's in any way bad. I think people want to do the best that they can. They want to work hard, but so often what we're seeing in the ambulance sector is people working really hard, but not doing the kind of activities that deliver the benefit that they want. So if you're spending hours of your shift sat outside of an A&E whilst you know that calls aren't being answered, you can imagine how that sort of really impacts on a person. They're not doing what they feel they should be doing and what they really should be doing. And you can sort of see how that filters through to what's often referred to as this concept of moral injury, where sort of in the day-to-day work, you're finding that you're having to make decisions, not do things, and not deliver the kind of level or quality of care that you want to. And that can really kind of hurt a person. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
And Jonathan, why has it been so much worse in some places than others when you look at response times and particularly handover delays? It's not a uniform picture across the country, is it?
It's a long way from being a uniform picture. I mean, the scale of variation we've seen at ambulance trust level has been fairly massive at times, actually. And I think one thing that's really important to bear in mind is the ambulance trusts cover really huge regions. So there'll be a lot of stuff going on. So if you're covering a region the size of the southwest, you could be working with as many as sort of 5-6 upwards trusts across that area. A huge range of socioeconomic, demographic kind of factors across that as well. So partly the variation is a reflection of the complexity that's out there, but also they're really kind of quite sort of practical and specific things that we hear about and we see. So I've been fortunate enough to have quite a few conversations with trust leaders over the course of the winter and kind of hear a bit about the specifics. And I think one conversation that's kind of really spring to mind is one recently with the team at South Devon and Torbay, which is a large acute trust, who over the course of the winter saw their handover delays really spiral up to quite a high level as demand really, really spiked. But they were able to recover their performance times fairly swiftly, not down perhaps to the level that they would have liked, but a long way down very rapidly. And I think one of the things that they really pointed out was the extra capacity that had been built into the trust there. So they had a relatively new acute medical unit, which essentially just creates more space to get a person transferred from the ambulance into the care of the trust. So that's one, not straightforward, but one sort of fairly clear way. But then you kind of look at a lot of the things that these trusts are doing with patient flow and the kind of culture that they're trying to generate and maintain within their trust. So at South Devon and Torbay, they kind of have this focus on the back door. So kind of getting patients out in a timelier fashion as possible, also creating space within the hospital to get people out of bed and sat up in what's known as a discharge lounge, and also getting it down to the really kind of specifics of getting a person out of hospital, ideally before midday, because you know that's when the kind of the next wave of demand starts, is kind of the daily cycle of urgent and emergency care pressures. And then kind of on the cultural side of things, there was this focus of it is everyone's job. It's kind of a thing that we are looking at solutions. We're trying to maintain calmness and safety, but at ward rounds, we're not giving an update on the issues that we have. We're focusing on our plans for the next step. There's kind of a focus on movement, of kind of not resting on your laurels. And you can kind of see how that could create quite a challenging working environment. And I think it's something that they recognize, that there's something there that's really challenging, like there's hard work going on, but the staff who are in caring or clinical roles are kind of freed up to do the caring jobs that they want to. So they're getting the satisfaction out of their shifts. They're not getting tied up in bureaucracy. They're focusing on making patients' lives better and working hard in doing that. And that's where the satisfaction comes from. So it's a kind of hard work that generates reward, I suppose.
So Jonathan, there's more investment that we've been told is heading the way of the ambulance service.
Mm.
This was announced in connection with the urgent and emergency care recovery plan, push to increase ambulance capacity. Is that going to crack the problem?
So it will definitely help. It was a substantial and quite a vital kind of investment in building capacity. So making sure we have more vehicles out on the road, creating more space in emergency departments, investing more in what are known as virtual wards to create more bed space, all of which are really, really vital things. So I'd say it's necessary. It's very welcome. Is it a silver bullet? I would have to say no, because I think one of the things we know about some of the pressures we're seeing in the ambulance sector and the urgent and emergency care pathway is that they go sort of far beyond that. So there are really important things about resolving some of the issues in social care, building capacity there that we still need to look at. We know that across the NHS, we've still got massive and chronic workforce shortages. So there's kind of points there around how we plan for a sustainable workforce. And there's also kind of just the fact that demand is just going to keep kind of going up. So we can't just keep on building more and more space. We need to think a bit more about prevention and about how we can support the ambulance sector to do more preventative care, focus on not just being a blue light kind of a service, but on more of that, keeping people well at home, perhaps offering more in the way of information and advice to patients so that they're treated in a setting that perhaps might be more appropriate. So there's a range of other options. I think it kind of breaks down into this vitally important bit of building capacity and investing in that. I think that's kind of been looked at for the year ahead. But there's the longer term issue about how urgent and emergency care works for the kind of population that we're going to have in the years ahead.
That's it. You can find out much more on the story of winter in the NHS, including case studies showing the great work by Trust to deal with unprecedented pressures, on our website, nhsproviders.org/winterwatch-2022-23. My thanks, as always, to our guests. We'll be back soon. A reminder, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag #TheProvidersPodcast. And keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.